Retina Rounds, podcast number 27. This week, we're honored to welcome a very special guest to Retina Rounds, Dr. Rishi Singh, the incoming chair of the Department of Ophthalmology at Mass General Brigham and Harvard Medical School. Dr. Singh has been a giant in medical education, retina research, and healthcare leadership, having served as professor of ophthalmology at the Cleveland Clinic Cole Eye Institute, vice president and chief medical officer of the Cleveland Clinic Martin Health System, as well as founder and president of the Retina World Congress. In this episode, Dr. Singh discusses the evolving demands on leaders in ophthalmology and the importance of pursuing one's passions to achieve professional success. Let's check it out.
Welcome, everybody, to our weekly Retina Rounds podcast. It's a great pleasure to have an old friend, Rishi Singh, joining us today. Rishi is an accomplished vitreoretinal surgeon and has become in recent years a leader in both academic retina and academic ophthalmology, as well as hospital administration. So Rishi, welcome to Retina Rounds.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
It's a great pleasure. It's a great pleasure. You know, I tend to start off these podcasts asking people about their journey and then delve into some personal philosophy as well as treatment issues. And so for you, why don't you tell our listeners where you grew up and how you became interested in medicine and then into retina in particular?
Yeah, sure. I actually grew up in New Hampshire. I'm a native New Englander, actually, by origin. And what actually drew me to medicine was probably in high school, where I was volunteering in a hospital and realized how much you could change people's lives with just simple things you did. It was one of those situations where, you know, you're just a candy striper, but just not a candy striper. You do things like, you know, wheel patients to their next destination, whether it's a radiology exam or to discharge or to the things. And those can be very joyful, and those can be very impactful, and those can also be very emotional. And for me, I realized how much welfare improvement we could provide in medicine in general. And then subsequent to that, when I came to medical school, realizing how much of a welfare impact ophthalmology surgeries could have on people, and particularly the retinal surgeries and retinal therapeutics, which at the time weren't a huge amount, as you know, many 25, 30 years ago, we didn't have a lot when we started, but look at where we are today, and look at the impact we've all had on patients.
It's rather, it is amazing. And I think for you, the theme seems to be impact, and your career has been remarkably impactful, but it doesn't surprise me that your motivation comes from the ability to have an impact. Tell us about where you went to medical school and who was it in ophthalmology that got you first excited about it?
Yeah, so it was, I was at Boston University for undergrad and graduate school. I was in one of those tracks that get you all the way through from the beginning. And I had decelerated for a year and worked with a researcher under an RPB grant for a year, fellowship grant. So I decelerated in medical school between my second and third year. And I'd spent time with a PhD researcher in my laboratory. Her name was Dr. Vickery Trinkus Randall. She's still around today at BU. And she was so helpful at guiding us in guiding me in a career of scientific investigation, really trying to understand the underpinnings of the time of corneal wound healing. That was what we had focused on the lab. And then that became the basis for potentially a therapeutic. And seeing like the animal models and the tissue culture models and equating them then to the clinic was where the translational research really just sparked my interest in this field and continued my journey into the science of it.
And so you did the 6-year, or in your case, 7-year program with a year of research. I don't think it's deceleration. I think it's acceleration. I always am positive about people taking time off to research, and we'll come back to that. And yeah. Then you finished there, and then where did you go from BU?
Residency at Mass Pioneer. Spent three wonderful years there with the luminaries of our field, Tony Adamus, Dimitri Azar, Klaus Dolman, Kathy Colby, Deborah Langston, so many, many people. Joan Miller was there at the time. She just became chair. Fred Jakobiak was still there. So
Evan
there,
Gurgudis.
Evan Gurgudis. I mean, the net list is so Simmons LaSalle. I mean, the list is like I couldn't even begin. I mean, these were people that had developed the textbooks in ophthalmology and all of their specific fields. I mean, I'm probably missing some people, so my apologies for those I'm missing. But just wonderful, impactful situation. And then I was learning.
Was Dean there yet? Dean
Dean
Elliott?
was not there. No. Dean came probably much later than that. But and then I was lured over to Cleveland Clinic, and it was really a combination of people there. Peter Kaiser, Hillel Lewis, Jonathan Sears were the people that were there. Andy Shackett was there, and really have helped educate me at the time of my fellowship there. And I said, Cleveland was a 2-year plan. My wife had said to me, "You have 2 years in Cleveland. We're going back to Boston." And 20 plus years later, we were still here. So,
Well, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Now you're in it, and so, I always refer to the Mass Eye and Ear as sort of the candy store of mentors. There are so many giants walking the halls, and their approachability is so great. And why don't you share with the audience the job that you've just accepted?
So I am the incoming chair of Mass Eye and Ear. I will be the professor of ophthalmology at Harvard Medical School. I'll be overseeing all of the Harvard hospitals now. So we have many hospitals under the Harvard umbrella: Children's Hospital, our hospitals, Beth Israel Deaconess Hospital, our Joslin Diabetes Center. So I am the leader of that group now.
That's a not small job, Rishi. And is it resonating at home?
It is. I just honestly, I'm still in utter humbleness and honor. This is a job of my dreams. It's what I really wanted to do ultimately in my career goals. I got sidetracked for a while in a good way. I was a hospital administrator for the past 3.5 years. But I learned a lot doing that. Actually, it was probably the one largest learning period of my entire career, especially on that side of the coin, and doing things in that realm, and in
Well,
leadership.
let's talk about that a little bit because there are a lot of people out there who are on an academic track and they're publishing and they're successful with their grants and they're successful with being very productive and impactful. But at a point, the growth curve could stand with some acceleration. And you took a big risk taking that job as an administrator. And so tell us about that a little bit. What job did you take? What did it entail? And did you have to relocate? And what was the turmoil? Because I know you sacrificed a lot to do that.
So I was very comfortable in Ohio, and I was doing things that I think when I sat down at the time and said, "I really want to be a department chair, what does that look like now?" The department chairs of the past are not the ones of the future. We have to deal as department chairs with the financial aspects of our departments ever so more tightly than before. Finding research to be fundable and continue to be able to support it is a very huge mission for all of us. Working on multiple sides of fundraising, these are aspects that maybe if you were trying, as you said, like in that realm of I need to write as many papers and grants and everything else, that's not what's going to help be successful from a foundational perspective for the future. It is a piece, right? It is one of the pieces, but it's also the pieces that I think make healthcare so challenging if you don't have those levels of understanding. So I made a conscious decision to go to Florida as part of our Cleveland Clinic system. We had acquired a hospital there, a hospital system, I should say. It was three hospitals under one umbrella, and I was the leader of those hospitals in Florida and an outpost. It was a nice part of Florida, don't get me wrong, but it was I had left a very comfortable position to go into a very difficult situation. As you can imagine, when you acquire a hospital, even though you put the jersey and the label on their jackets, they don't have the same culture. So it was a cultural upheaval in this hospital. It was a large physician egress, which I encountered a lot of private doctors who didn't like what big medicine looked like. And I was trying to appease them successfully. So I think in the past 3 years, inheriting a very negative financial budget, we lost $100 million the first year I was there in the hospital.
And that was just you.
The second year we lost 50 million, and then finally we have turned the needle for the first time in 7 years, and we're budget positive for the fast
So just
past.
for our listeners, it wasn't all of that was a rosy financial situation, and then you arrived and they lost 100 million. I think losing 100 million was probably a great achievement because you only lost 100.
We were coming out of COVID at the time. If expenses went up the wazoo. Having physicians come and leave is expensive. It was something that I really garnered enough understanding of to really say, listen, keeping people in your walls is very important, and as much as you can try to do to encourage them to stay with you is something that can be a huge, obviously, benefit to the patients, but also a very huge cost savings to the organization, because you're not off-boarding and onboarding new doctors, searching for new ones, trying to find the right fits, all those sort of things. So that's it's it was really a fantastic experience, and Cleveland Clinic enabled me to do all that. And I have to say, they took probably a risk on me as much as I did on them. I think it was a very, very equal risk. Because I'm an ophthalmologist. What does an ophthalmologist know about hospital medicine or, inpatient surgical care? But yet, every skill set we have in ophthalmology is completely applicable to this stuff. We run highly efficient clinics. We've mastered ambulatory surgery centers. We've done buy and bill medicine. These are really the foundations for the future of healthcare in many ways. Inpatient surgical procedures and such are going down each year. And so having that skill set, having that background was hugely helpful to me and really helpful to the organization. And hence, I believe I've left it in a much better state in Florida now after 4 years of being there than it was when I first got there.
And I'm sure you've grown tremendously and had to face innumerable gut-wrenching decisions.
I have to say the toughest one of all was, we had two maternity wards, and neither has really had sufficient numbers of births to really be proficient for the staff. I mean, when you have 60 births a month, your obstetricians and gynecologists will tell you're putting your doctors at risk because they don't do the procedures enough to be proficient. And hence we had to consolidate. And I tell you, Steve, I mean, I had to go to so many town meetings, and there was, picketers outside the hospital at one point. And I mean, these are tough decisions to make, but either we close a unit and keep another one open, or we close everything and, we don't have a hospital anymore in this area. So those are the types of decisions we're making. And it was tough. It was really tough for people in the community.
So the Cleveland Clinic is obviously one of the great medical institutions in the country, and it's both public, private. Well, it's a combination being public, private, and academic, and it's straddled that foundational infrastructure for decades. Harvard is a different beast. In fact, Harvard is a different beast than just about every academic institution. There are only a handful of universities that rightfully belong in the same sentence as the Harvard and the Harvard health systems. And so now, what are the challenges you perceive coming from, as you call it, big medicine to what I call big academia? I mean, obviously the financial challenges are the same, but you've got another one, which is you've got the smartest people in the world on your faculty and the most accomplished people in the world in your faculty. And your mission, I know, is not just to retain them and to have them be productive, but it's to figure out a way to carve out time for them to actually think. And that's hard. So philosophically, what is it about this, the challenge that makes you think that you can do this? Because I know you can, but I want to hear what you think.
So if you look at the way that the Cleveland Clinic is run, and I just give you as a caveat, it's a highly efficient medical system. Yes, we weren't maybe the top of the top for research like Harvard is, but we certainly did a lot of research, and we did it in a very efficient fashion, and we're able to do it alongside good clinical care. The Harvard system has challenges for a lot of reasons. There's some state challenges. not being able to build more ORs because we have days wait to surgery for 90 days for some of our eye patients. Clinic is constrained because the number of patients we can see in our clinics and the footprint we have is constrained. On top of the fact that we are growing at a huge rate. The last year we've grown almost every year for the last 5 years, for that matter, we've grown anywhere from 5 to 10% in
We
volume.
meaning Harvard.
Harvard, yeah.
Yeah.
So we have this huge clinical engine. We have this huge research engine, which is at risk, given all of the changes in the administration activities and so on and so forth. And we also have a training program that is fantastically producing wonderful residents and fellows and future leaders of this field. We need to support all three missions. So how do we do that? My goals really are to be the connector between individuals. I think one of the big things that we have to do as an organization is to row in the same direction. And part of that rowing in the same direction means if the idea is that we're going to see more new patients, how do we all do that? How do we have that so that everyone in the organization knows that that is one of our goals amongst many? The other goals are with our funding is to find alternative mechanisms for funding. We have so, for long times in this institution at Harvard, by that I mean, have really not worked on some of the activities that might allow us to work with industry and to be supported by industry and some of our wonderful researchers who are hugely productive and working on future therapeutics. I mean, Steve, when I started seeing what they were working on, I was like, wow, you guys are going to cure blindness in these conditions with this, what is happening right now with the genetic work in glaucoma, with a lot of the work that's happening in neuro-ophthalmology, with some of the newer stuff that's happening in translational research in our gene therapy unit. I mean, they need to be supported. The question becomes, where do they get their support from? Yes, truly, NEI, NIH funding will exist and we'll keep pushing for that. But are we really developing enough strategic partnerships with people? And one of the ones that I can tell you about just off the bat that we're have had and we haven't, we need to do more with is Astellas. We have a fantastic research collaboration with Astellas on gene and cell therapy. And have we done enough with that? Have we really focused on that? Have we gotten garnered enough translational research from that? It's yet to be seen. I think we have a lot of work to do with that. And it's multiple different fields, not just gene and cell therapy for, retina. It's glaucoma, it's neuro diseases. They're focused on many, many different conditions, and we can help them with that.
Well, as you know, I've worked a lot with the Astellas group in Boston and published and worked with Bob Lanza and some of the other greats in that company over the years, including those first RPE transplant patients. And they're a great group to work with, and they are fabulous. And the group at Harvard has supported in both formally and informally. By informally, I mean people who've left Harvard to go and work in that Astellas Institute, and they're just fabulous. And I think that's an interesting way to look at it. And that is definitely one of the ways that I think an academic institution of that quality has an opportunity to do to juice the coffers, so to speak, as things become more challenging. You've got such a great group of retina folks there, besides Dean, who is just spectacular, and the tumor service is amazing. And one of my personal favorites in the of the young investigators is Lizzie Rosin, who's doing just beautiful work looking at proliferative disease together with Elliot and others. And in fact, our foundation awarded her a best paper at Yale. And with a little bit of, sorry, at Vail, not Yale, best paper at the Vail vitrectomy meeting, and she won a research award. And I have nothing but respect for your whole group. The challenge for you, of course, is going to be not running them into the ground clinically, carving out research support, creating an engine that allows them and facilitates grants. And at the same time, as you know, as the chair at Harvard, you're going to be on the national stage. And you've cultivated a great relationship with the American Academy of Ophthalmology and the American Society of Retina Specialists and Retina Society, Macula Society. What's your plan for supporting organized medicine as one of the pillars of the foundational tripod that holds us up?
So I have to say we owe a debt of gratitude to all these societies that you have belonged to and worked tirelessly with, and I've helped support and work through as well. I mean, they are the reason for why we have our practice environment right now. And our goals are really to leverage our expertise to help them better understand what we can do as a practice. So as an example, one of the big focuses that Lizzie's focused on, for example, and others at the institution are on our data science work and working on a lot of our big data understandings. So, a drug comes out today and it shows promise, it shows durability. It may have the same price as another branded drug, yet it's in the step therapy format. There's research that our group has done that's shown that that drug has a huge quality improvement for patients and huge cost improvement for our practices. So we should not be focused on step therapy for some of these things. I mean, obviously, Avastin, bevacizumab or Avastin aside, these branded drugs are very different, the newer ones especially. So helping supporting the research and helping support it through data science work is one of the aspects amongst many. I think the other aspect is going to be around really our practice environment and making it simple. I think, when you said asked me the question about the challenges in our own practice, like what do how do we support those researchers? We have to get rid of all of the minutiae that goes into these systems so that they can then focus on what makes them great, which is bringing ideas to the table and executing on those ideas. But the other stuff that we deal with, booking surgeries or, having to wait for OR time and for clinics not to be efficiently run and so on and so forth, not having enough support people, that's where I'm really going to make an impact and hopefully streamline them. So we are working at top of license. We don't want to work at something that you can do and I can do that somebody else on our staff can do. Is something that we need to start to figure out and to get rid of. And hence, top of license work is going to be hugely important for our group to get us to where we need to be. Because
Wow.
otherwise, you can't be that trifecta, right? You can't be that perfect, a clinical scientist educator. That's a tough trifecta to have these days. But unless you have support staff, and I've had the benefit of hugely impactful, clinical administrators, med secretaries, administrative support people, programmatic people, none of the things I have done to date would have been done without the teams around me. And realistically, that's what I want to enable in our group over there.
Well, that's a challenge. Making the environment free enough that your talent or top of license, as you call it, can innovate and impact with integrity without having to call the OR and be the remora and lock on to somebody else's OR time is a challenge, or to fit a few more patients into clinic. Those are all really, really important, and I'm sure that the group there will be thrilled if you can execute against those goals. Those are spectacular goals. How do you see your role interfacing with organized medicine, specifically the Academy and the National Institutes?
Yeah, we have to be we have to obviously be there to discuss and help to lobby toward the what needs to happen, right? So, the focus of the field, obviously has to be defined, and it'll be defined by heavy research organizations like, UCLA, Johns Hopkins, Wills, ourselves, others who are in the research realm. We will be focused on the priorities for, the next few years. With the current administration, we have to decide how we fit into it. I have to say that, initially, as much as we don't like the make, some people may not like the Make America Healthy Again initiatives, ICARE falls in that realm really well, actually. So we can actually figure out ways of reducing, macular degeneration, glaucoma progression, through metabolomics, through dietary things. And we have huge researchers focused on metabolomics. Deepa Hussain, for example, in our group has focused on that for many years and done that work. So we need to have our the focus put on those aspects to help support those initiatives. And hence, we can fit in very, very well with anyone for that matter. And honestly, on the part of the practice environment, I think we have to decide, what is reasonable from a practice perspective and what is totally, needs to be scientifically debunked. You and I have been parts and seen many studies go through in the past few years. Some of them were not stellar. And they got maybe they were at the time FDA approved. And the question was, should we really be spending our, should we really have our expenses being, or our insurance companies paying for these drugs or paying for these aspects? I mean, I think that there needs to be some evidence-based infused in all of this. It just can't be a play for approval all the time.
Well, it's interesting. I had the opportunity this week to meet Dr. Makary, the new head of the FDA, and I was very, very impressed. Shockingly so. Very, very fresh, innovative outlook around getting rid of 50 to 100-year-old traditions at the institution that he's taking on, getting rid of the paper, getting rid of the silos, getting rid of the fiefdoms. Get it, bringing common sense into play, using synthetic control groups, getting to faster approvals, getting to functional approvals. And from that perspective, ophthalmology does fit in very nicely to parts of the philosophy. But as you know, and we'll stay away from this, there's a lot yet to unfold here. I am thrilled for you in the challenges that you face, and I'm even more thrilled for the faculty, the researchers, the professors, and all of the institutions that you listed, because they're in for a treat with your leadership. And Rishi, we are all rooting for you, and we feel like we're in the corner of the boxing ring, massaging you and putting a little Vaseline on your wounds and sending you back out in there. But I hope that the pummeling doesn't come from within, because I think you are truly an advocate for your team, and it's a big enough role, and it's probably one of the biggest chairs, if not the biggest chairman role in our field, that you've got the neon H up there in the sky, and we put that up when we need help. It's like the bat signal. So here comes Rishi with a cape on, and I can't think of anyone that makes us more relaxed and thrilled that it's you. So
Thank you.
congratulations on that. Tell me about what you've been able to do clinically over the last few years. Have you had to have you been able to continue your clinical practice to some extent?
Yeah, so that was Steve, a big challenge for me. So I moved to Florida. I was told I was gonna be clinically active. Turned out there was no clinic in Florida, so I had to start it from scratch.
That can be a
So
blessing.
it was an absolute blessing. It was a highly efficient, well, according to me, obviously, but highly efficient practice that saw a lot of patients. Initially, I think people questioned, like, what are you doing? You're inheriting a lot of work here. And for me, I had to walk the walk and talk the talk in order for my physician group, physician members of my practice, the urologists, the orthopedic surgeons, the cardiothoracic doctors, the cardiologists, because they could then see me in clinic and realize I understood their pain points and I had to understand their pain points. And hence, as a chair, I will still practice when I'm in Boston. But starting from scratch and looking at each and every aspect of what we did and why we did it and what was extraneous and what needed to be thrown out and what needed to be kept. Training individuals, I think it's been incredibly impactful. So yes, for the past 3 years, I've been doing medical retina and surgical retina up in Cleveland, and then I stopped surgical retina about a year ago for a bunch of different issues, and now I'm going to be resuming again surgical retina in a year or so, in this year when I get back to Boston. But I had to keep that going. It was a hugely impactful field, and vis-a-vis, I also did continue my research efforts. And the other part I did is I continued my continuing medical education efforts. You know, one of the big aspects to Mass Eye and Ear and to any institution for that matter is that if you can educate others on the best practices, then you've then, you know, given that tenfold out to the wider community rather than that single patient in your office, right? The impact you can have on a broader healthcare community by continuing medical education is huge. And I love doing those programs. I love educating others. I think that there's a fine balance that we can strike because we can educate them on things that are evidence-based. We can be unbiased in that, and it's really great. So, you know, that sort of aspect of it that has been in my practice has continued the other way through. So I have been, you know, working with industry, advising early phase companies, but also doing CME activities and starting a practice from scratch while running the hospital. And it was really impactful. I think the one aspect of it that I really actually enjoyed, and this is I think supportive of the AAO and their aspects too, is how do we work with optometry? Because I did hire an optometrist when I was in Florida, a medical optometrist who helped me. But there are scope concerns in that, I think. And obviously we know those scope concerns. So how do we put those lines in the sand? And we did very well together because they are our sort of advanced practice provider, if you want to call them that. You know, if you have in a clinic, you'd have a primary care doctor and a nurse practitioner. They're sort of our nurse practitioners. And so how do we help them without hurting ourselves? And how do we work together so that we can all work in that same, you know, same top of license I mentioned to you before? And it was a really educational aspect for me.
That's fantastic. And so you're planning on staying busy clinically in Boston, and you've obviously got a lot of administrative activity. Let's talk, our audience here at Retina Rounds is global, and we've got listeners in China and in all over Asia, all over the Middle East, all over Europe, and all over Latin America and Central America, as well as Mexico. And so when young people in their careers seek their advice from their mentors. So let's just run through a little bit. You've mentored and trained so many people that have turned out to be great. We've shared a number of them. Some of them are still on the faculty in Cleveland, others other places. And they're some of my fondest trainees. And I've seen the polish that they've gotten from working with you. But share a little bit when you've got a Let's start with a resident who comes to you and says, Dr. Singh, I don't know how to choose a subspecialty, and I don't know whether I want to be in academics or I want to be in private practice or now private equity. What do you suggest to the resident to do at that early stage, even when they're years away from deciding?
So it's a great question, and it comes up even more now than ever before because of the variations of the practices. And you know, when you and I were, you know, again 20 years ago together, when I first met you 25 years ago, in fact, Steve, you know,
Hit me again, yeah.
these entities didn't exist at all, right? I mean, they were not even around. But I always
Well, the last cycle of private equity was just fading out when you were coming in.
So what I always get back to, and this is the way I've run my life, is what makes you happy? And it sounds so simplistic, but it's absolutely the truth, right? Is your happiness derived from a large paycheck, or is it derived from, you know, being in a practice but making potentially less money, but being with friends and colleagues? Is it derived from, you know, being a researcher and being tied to an academic institution because you want a lab and you want, you know, basic science work and you want to be able to do that? There's a whole host of things that make people happy, right? And when I talk to those residents, I talk to the fellows, I talk to the medical students, that to me is the piece that I always tell them. You can go to a fantastic institution for training. It will be in maybe Timbuktu for that person, and they'll be away from their family or their spouse or their significant other, and that might not be palatable. And so I think we make, unfortunately, sometimes decisions based upon what we see as sort of that best, and not necessarily what's best for ourselves. And hence, I've been a big proponent of making sure people realize that they make those decisions and try to make them for their own happiness ultimately. And that's the way I've driven myself through my career. There's been times where I was courted by very, very nice private practice groups, and I didn't go. And what really didn't drive me to them wasn't because I didn't want to be in a private practice. It was because I saw this greater mission in my head that I love teaching, I love educating. Can I still do this if I do that? Can I lead, researchers and connect people and other parts of the organization to make things happen better for the organization? That's what really has driven me through this process.
So what I'm hearing is something that we've heard from many of the giants in retina that we've interviewed here on Retina Rounds, and that is happiness comes from satisfaction, and satisfaction comes from not only being true to yourself, but giving back to society in ways that are not just for financial remuneration, whether it's organized medicine research, teaching, mentorship, moving the field forward in ways that make you feel good about yourself. And so you try and push that experience into the perspective of your trainees or those seeking advice from you. Is that a fair?
I pushed into my son. My son was a finance major at The Ohio State, and comes back 1 year and goes, "I want to be pre-med now." And I was like, "Why not? I thought you're going to be a finance bro. This is going to be great. I was really looking forward to financial advice from you." But it didn't make him happy. It was very much akin to that. He's now, in his junior year of college, he's going to start to get his bearings and apply to medical school in the near term future. But it's true for any of us. It's the way we advise each other. And hence there have been some definite forks in the road where we've made decisions. Both you and I have made decisions where it was for our own good and our own interest ultimately.
Well, our own happiness and our own satisfaction, and really from being privileged enough to be in a position to be able to really give back and affect not only our patients, but our populations that we care for, and even broader populations, and sometimes even be lucky enough to influence the standard of care. So that's one side of the coin, Rishi. Now, you've been on admissions committees for years at the Cleveland Clinic, and I'm guessing that some of what happened at the Cleveland Clinic will translate over to what happens at Harvard's multiple programs, but some of it's set in stone. But you've also been at Harvard, so you know. A lot of our listeners want to know, how do I get into Harvard? So let's just say this before you have to say it, I'll say it. Table stakes to even applying for Harvard include great scores, great metrics, great recommendations, and impactful research. But there are hundreds of people like that. And so, what is it that makes someone stand out?
So I have to say this, you've probably seen this in clinic with people yourselves, but one of the things, if you have any chance of having any exposure to these institutions, you get to know people in the institution, and you'll shine if you can come and do a very few number of things. The first is that realize where you are and what you can do to help. I've been in the clinic scenario once where I was in, I remember, an office, and I'm talking to a patient, and the patient's crying about the diagnosis of geographic atrophy, and then the medical students or the fellow, I forget who it was at the time, said to me, "Are we going to be injecting this patient today?" or something like that. Really, like, was out of the way out of where we needed to be at that point in time, right? I'm in a busy clinic. I'm way behind. I'm running around. I'm trying to get a printer, print out on the printer, and the person is just standing there. These are little things that you can just sort of tell that people have this sort of sense about them that they fall into the flow of the clinic. And I'm not asking to be indentured servitude. That's not it at
No,
all.
but I'm
Just
hearing you say describing situational awareness.
situational clinical awareness is huge, number one. I would say that. Number two, I think it's about the passion that you show in what you're doing, right? So, showing up on time, being there and asking good questions that are not something that you can read in a book, that you really need an expertise of somebody to look
Okay, so now it's getting interesting. So actual demonstration of original thought.
Not ChatGPT, yes, absolutely, because we realize how much it's eroding our brains. But we're really trying to have
Actual intelligence you're talking
actual
about.
intelligence, yeah. And honestly, some of the greatest CVs and the greatest long bibliographies of all the stuff they did doesn't make up for being emotionally intelligent and really having that, kind of like personality that we really want to be with. And I'll say this much, I would pick a lesser candidate with lesser scores for a great personality, a great fit with the organization than a stellar person who is just off the charts in every way. I mean, there's a fine line, I think, between crazy and genius. Sometimes that line gets a little blurry at the top of it. But that's truly it. And I have to say, like, I applied from Boston University to Mass Eye and Ear. At the time, I never knew I was going to match there. But I had great board scores. I had great, obviously, all the prerequisites. But I had spent some amazing time with people there and really impressed them at the time. And it was Deborah Langston, Klaus Dolman, Tonia Damis, especially. And those individuals really were the supportive nature for me to get into the institution. They wrote my letters for me because I'd spent so much time clinically. So as much as the grades are stellar, their institutions are important, it's really about the person and sort of the fit ultimately.
And you assess the fit by most effectively by an audition rotation, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and I have to say that this is something we've done a great job of at Mass Eye and Ear, has really opened ourselves up for rotations. And by the way, for people from other countries too. And in Cleveland, I did the same thing. I had a huge pipeline of individuals from Brazil, from Mexico, from other countries that were coming to do visitations with us for a few weeks. It was a great way of doing that. And a lot of the work that I did actually is why I started Retina World Congress. It was because I would go, you and I have traveled to these countries, and we see amazing things happening there. But those individuals don't get podium time necessarily in the US to educate our US audiences as much as we can educate them. So can we find a United Nations of Retina? And that was what Retina World Congress ended up being.
Tell us a little bit more about Retina World Congress. For those in our audience who don't know about it, what should they know, and are they welcome?
Yeah. So this has been a labor of love for over 15 years, and I had an individual who really believed in this concept. And when we sat down with individuals at the ASRS, at the Brazilian Retina Society, at the Latin American Retina Society, they all wanted to participate. And what they were committing to essentially was to say they would all send delegates, send people from their individual organizations. We're now over 50 retina societies strong across the globe, who send in over 170, speakers to our meeting each year, and they all are on the podium presenting really original stuff that we have never seen before. And it's a fantastic collaboration because things that occur sometimes in Europe or in Asia can teach us what we can do better, and vis-a-vis, sometimes we can teach them some things here that we're learning about. So,
All the time.
yeah.
If you're lucky enough to travel the world in the ophthalmology and retina sphere, I promise you, you will learn.
Yeah.
The
Yeah.
there is no monopoly on the right way. Absolutely not. And so I think RWC is amazing
Yeah.
from that perspective. Where is it this year?
Fort
And
Lauderdale.
when it?
We've kept it in the old Arvo haunted grounds for many years now, and
Well, those aren't the old Arvo haunted grounds. Those are the semi-old Arvo
Am I
haunted
old?
grounds,
Those there,
right?
yeah.
Yeah,
So,
but and what, when is it this year?
it's going to be in May again this year. The exact dates are we'll be able to send out to people. But the organization has grown so much. I'm now the past president and founder of it over many years. I was the president for two cycles of it, and my role now is minimal compared to it, but it's so great to see, and you've seen this too in your own career. When you can start something and it continues beyond you, it means it actually is meaningful, right? It means it has legs. You don't need to be stewarding it every year and making sure it's running. I don't participate nearly as much as I used to in it, other than the speaker and program, help on the medical program. but everything else is done by the team now, of doctors who are all together working at it, and they're from all countries working on it, which is really fantastic to see.
Which is why it's so successful and so unique and wonderful. And really, when you give birth to a meeting or a society like that, or an amalgamation of societies, a congress, that is one of the most highly evolved activities we can perform as surgeons, right up there with attending unique societies and traveling around. So, what sort of surgical experience do you find? Or even medical experience, but let's just start with surgical experience. Let's say someone's a aspiring vitreoretinal provider in another country. What's the ideal time for them to come to Harvard to be an observer or an international fellow? Is it when they're optimally trained? Is it partway through their training? What is it? What's the optimal time for them to
So
come?
I think it depends on what the end goals are, right? So if the end goal is to be a resident or to be in our training program, then wholeheartedly I would say try to come in for one of the fellowship programs we have, and then impress us with those fellowship programs, because we do take we have taken foreign medical graduates through the fellowship programs in some areas. Research mainly in that realm, but research does not mean that you can't impress us clinically, right? You're going to be in clinic with us and spend time with us. That will then lead to potentially a residency slot for you in our program. I would say the other aspect of it is coming in for observerships for a month or 2 months or even 3 months, and spending time with us in Boston and really understanding what the service is like in all aspects, and that can be done at any given time, even post residency work, if that is comfortable to them. It depends on different countries, right? Some countries do these things where they have a very, very, short residency program. Some have longer residency tracks. You're aware of some of the UK systems that have these combined programs, which is almost like a 6-year program of undergrad and medical school
Well,
together.
you back in the day in the UK, it was unlimited. You stayed in your fellowship until the job you wanted came up, and usually someone had to die or retire.
So we see a lot of people coming at different aspects of their career. It just depends on what they're looking for, honestly. Sometimes they just want to come in and spend a period of time and go back to their home countries and say, I spent time here, I learned a lot from here. I was a pupil of, back in the day of that surgeon or this person or whatever it was. That's all they're looking for. And that's okay too. We don't mind that. We're here to educate and we're here to train. And so having them here is really a value add to us ultimately. We know that.
Yeah, that's great advice for people who, and that's for our listeners, that should be very exciting to you because that's an open door. I think back to Klaus Dolman, who I guess recently passed, and one of the nicest, great guys in our field, fit, tanned, and brilliant, and incisive. And you must pinch yourself periodically when you think that you're going to be sitting at his desk, and not to mention Evan and Joan and everybody else who's been there. But Klaus, at the time we were coming up, was super formative, and he really was almost like a superhero or a titan. And subsequent chairs have done a lot to demystify the job, but what does it feel to you to be taking over that role?
Well, I have his a great grandson, Thomas Dolman, who's a cornea specialist of their group now, and I have to say he's an epitome of his grandfather at the time. This institution has driven eye care to a great extent, far, far forward. Some of the first cataract surgeons were at Mass Eye and Ear. Obviously, the pioneering work around angiogenic therapy, photodynamic therapy were done here. Insights into recently into GLP-1s and their effects on the eye have been done by our neuro-ophthalmology service. This group is fantastic. And honestly, I say this, Stephen, in the kindest way. I will certainly defer to them and their scientific endeavors because they are off the charts smart. My goal is really, as many chairs go, is to really be the person who connects teams together to help set goals and initiatives, to work, have them work together more than ever before, to break down the silos that are existed, and to make them feel that they're valued and the institution understands their value. That was one of the big driving reasons for me to go to MassIONEER. I remember sitting down with the people who are in the search committee, and they said, we get it. We know we value eye care, and we realize what you guys bring to the table. You are a huge portion of our research funding. You are a huge portion of our scientific endeavors here. You have fundable labs that are all over the place. They realize how much of a gem this institution is. It's 200 plus years old now, and they wanted to support it. That was really refreshing, in this realm of medicine that we're in, especially when I was in, administration. If you told somebody you're kind of investing in an outpatient practice, they might not be that interested in you because of the fact that, they're not a revenue driver. But Harvard gets it, and they have raised monies and have endowments to support us, just like UCLA and other organizations do. But we can't simply rely on those endowments. We have to work on the future. So.
You're going to have hundreds of reports, people reporting to you, hundreds. And so, are you anxious about how you might organize I know you very well, and I can tell the people at Harvard that your hiring is very hierarchical, but your organizations are very egalitarian, and that's how you build teams. I mean, you personally, I've seen you do it, and that's a from me, that's a big compliment. And so I know you're going to give people agency, but how are you going to manage it? I mean, that's just organizationally, it must be, besides just the shock of being the chair. And I say that to you, and with all the respect possible, because it is a shocking position, no matter who gets it. Just the daunting nature of the size of it. I mean, I remember talking to Joan, and I think she had to meet one-on-one with hundreds of people. I mean, two meetings a day for the year. Just to have the 360 once a year. Talk to me about how you're thinking about that.
So I came when I was in Florida. I had 5,000 employees, roughly around 280 doctors when I left there. We doubled the number of doctors in the past 3.5 years being there. We hired that many physicians. And this is something that I really have become very aware of. You have to give leaders, and you have to cultivate the next generation of leaders, and you have to give them the latitude to do their work, right? So we have, thankfully, a very, very intricate org structure already. There's pieces missing from it. I think that will be value add when we get there and do that sort of thing. But those organizational leaders will be the people that I will be meeting with to set the direction. And together, we will set direction. We will determine what needs to be completed and done. And then I will rely on them. I'm not a micromanager. I'm a team player, and I want them to do that. Now, I will make myself available also to meet with those individuals because I think that access to the chair is very important. I don't want anyone to feel like, oh, I can't go to somebody and talk to them. But annual professional reviews, like you said, those are actually hugely impactful times, right? It's a time for you to sit down with an individual doctor, which I plan to do with our team, and say, how are things going? Are we meeting your expectations? Are you meeting our expectations? And hence, what is the feedback on your leader that's leading you? Those are conversations that are just so valuable to have, and we're going to start to have them when we start there. But that's going to help to, I think, create a level of really shared governance in that way, that the shared governance will be that the service line leaders will work alongside me, and they'll be all feeling like we're, again, wearing the same jersey, understanding what we're getting toward and working in the same direction. And vis-a-vis, I think that that's going to be a way to sort of diffuse that work. By the way, I wouldn't have signed up for this job if I didn't expect it to be a night and weekend proposition either. So I'm well aware of the time commitment, but I think you have to do this. This is where the physicians and what we're dealing with is our single most important resource in the entire place. The
Yeah,
building can burn
Rishi,
down.
yeah, I got to say, when When this job opened up, it created a lot of anxiety in those of us who care so much about institutions like this. And to have you stepping in here is great news. It's great news for the field. It's great news for the institution. It's great news for your faculty. And I hope that that you stay as motivated as you are now, because it's obviously going to be choppy for a while, and there'll be a transition period. But you've done this enough times now, and you've managed almost bigger organizations, to be honest. And just because they weren't Harvard didn't mean they weren't headstrong. They might have been even more headstrong. So here's my you mentioned all wearing the same jersey. So let's get down to the really tough questions now. So are you peeling off the Cavaliers jersey to reveal a Celtics jersey, or has it always been a Celtics jersey?
It's always been a Celtics jersey. It's always been a I've had a baseball hat on the back of my door since I came to Cleveland. It was a Red Sox hat, unfortunately, but it was always on the back of my door. I've always had that in me. I grew up in New England. This is my home. So I am going home
So
for a while.
you walk around Cleveland with your Celtics jersey and your Red Sox hat, or are you just politic enough to hide it?
Under a bunch of other clothes. Yes, I do.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Well, the Boston community, the New England community is lucky to have you coming. I know the Retina Service is excited to have you coming. And the researchers in organized medicine are excited that you're coming. And on behalf of the field, we're just thrilled. On behalf of our listeners, Rishi, you're taking the time to spend with Retina Rounds is a real privilege for our listeners. And we reach out to Pradeep Prasad has done such a great job with the daily surgical cases. I was at the Retina Society last week meeting with a young fellow from China, and she spent some time at UCLA when I was there. And she was telling me that she and her group listen to Retina Rounds every day, and they value the podcast because it allows them a perspective into the accomplishments of giants. And so it's really great that you take them the
That's
time,
great.
and it's so impactful across the globe. So Rishi Singh, how does this sound? The incoming chairman of the Department of Ophthalmology in Harvard Hospital's Eye Care.
Thank
Thank you
you.
for spending the time
Yeah.
at Retina Rounds with
And
us.
thank you for doing the Retina Rounds. I have to say, these organizations, the people you've spoken to, I've actually had a chance to watch some of these, as well as Pradeep Prasad's Retina Rounds. They've been really impressive, and I think it's educating our entire community. So kudos to both of you for doing this work.
Well, just so we've reached out to a number of the retina faculty at Harvard, and so far they've all been too busy. But it's not for lack of wanting to, but we'll get them.
Yeah,
We'll get
no, we
them.
will get them for you. So.
We'll get them. And the Harvard, by the way, the Mass Eye and Ear Fellowship has evolved so much. And under Dean, I just can't, you know this to be true, but Dean Elliott took it to places that it really belonged, and it belongs, and it's he really deserves a huge shout out for the great work that he's done there.
Yeah, I think one of the big, really other contributions has been our surgical training program, which we offer to all the new residents and fellows coming in for each year in July. And it's in Boston. It's a fantastic program. They've run it for the Harvard vitrectomy course for the past probably 4 or 5 years, and it's been now chaired by John Miller and a few others. Lizzie Rawson is on the roster as well, and a few others are joining there. Nima Patel. They've done a fantastic job educating the next generation of surgeons through that
Well,
program, hands-on. So it's great.
John is fantastic, and I mean, I still have trouble looking at him as an adult, but having watched him grow up, I mean, he was so big, he was a man child before he was a man, but he's rapidly evolving into a giant in our field as well. And so congratulations, Rishi, and congratulations to the whole staff. And on behalf of Retina Rounds, thanks for participating.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
If you enjoyed this video, please visit us at retinarounds.com. There you can sign up for our email list. You'll get a notification every time a new video is posted. And if you have an interesting video or a tip or trick that you'd like to share, please follow the links on our website and you can upload your video there. Thanks so much for watching.